Julie Smith, and I'm the program manager for the Engage Breakfast Series. On behalf of all of us at Leadership Austin, thank you so much for being here today. This is the fifth of our Growing Divide series. These are difficult conversations, and we're so glad that you're here to listen and to share your voice, and even more importantly, to continue sharing your voice and continue these discussions when you leave the room today. So thank you so much for being here. We have an outstanding panel, and I know that you'll enjoy the breakfast. Tell me, who's here for the first time? Wonderful. Well, an extra warm welcome to you. I know that you're surrounded by a lot of passionate community members, and thank you for being here. I want to take just a couple minutes to thank our partners in this series. Engage would not be possible without the support of the Austin Board of Realtors, which is our presenting sponsor. Paul Hilgers is here to talk with you in just a minute. Our other sponsors are listed in the middle of your table, and we're just so very, very thankful for their support. I want to thank everybody at KXAN. Their team is wonderful in supporting this series, and our friends here at the Long Center. I'd actually like to hand it over to Colin, who will welcome you to the Long Center. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Colin Acock. I'm the development director here at the Long Center. It's so great to see all of you who are here for the first time and everyone else who has been here before. A lot going on at the Long Center. It's the spring season. It's very, very busy. This weekend is the Ballet Austin Swan Lake in Dell Hall for Mother's Day, so make sure to check that out. We just launched season 8, which is this little card on your table, a little preview of everything coming up this season. And since we're in year 7 right now, this little card right here is for our birthday party. Our annual gala, Purple Party 7, is happening May 16th, not this Saturday, but next Saturday, celebrating 7 years of the Long Center. And the Blues Brothers are performing. We have a great after party that is being sponsored by Total Wine & More, which is moving into the Austin market. So free beer and wine at the after party. There are some tickets available and a very few limited VIP tickets, which include the dinner beforehand on the city terrace and a few tables as well. You can go online, check it out, buy tickets. My contact information is there if you want to talk more. We have a little bit of time for that. Thank you so much for being here. This partnership with Leadership Austin has been tremendous for us. It has really activated our mornings and helped us round out our offerings here at the Long Center. So thank you so much for being here, and I'm glad the weather held out just a little bit for this morning. And I would like to introduce Paul Hilgers, the president of the Austin Board of Realtors.
Good morning. Good morning. There you are there. Okay, good. I am Paul Hilgers. I am actually the CEO of the Austin Board of Realtors. The president is a volunteer leader of our 11,000 member association. And I can't tell you how honored we have been to be a partner with the best Leadership Austin program in all of the country, led by the best executive director and his staff, Christopher Kennedy. I want to thank all of you who have come again, and those particularly who are here for the first time. This is, again, I think, part of the mission of Leadership Austin and why we're so proud to be a part of this. I've been traveling around the country a lot lately, and whenever I tell anybody that I'm from Austin, Texas, they literally respond with, "Oh, wow, gosh, that's the place I want to go and live." And I say, please, have you heard of traffic? No, I mean, you know, you're really getting to the point to where you just are saying, hold it for a second. Of course, I don't do that because I'm in the profession of promoting the homes, sales of homes. But for those who do that. But the reality is that our image is one that is not truly accurate. And I think those of you who have been here for all 5 of the sessions about the Great Divide recognize that we have a huge challenge. And the challenges that we face as a community require your engagement. They require your action. And some of the things that I think you should think through is to go back and look at who participated in these sessions. Contact those people. You have organizations here that are represented. We have some of the finest nonprofit organizations of any place in the country, literally. They're represented here. We have some of the finest coalitions of people and of nonprofits and of institutions trying to figure out how to solve this problem. It has to be solved in a uniquely Austin, Texas way. It doesn't matter, believe me, it doesn't matter what the hell they're doing in Portland. There, I said it. It doesn't matter what they're doing almost any place else, because we have to do it our way, and that requires your involvement and your engagement. So find some place to become engaged in this issue. There's so many different ways to do it. So many different ways. We at the housing at the Austin Board of Realtors have chosen Habitat as one of our major efforts. And figure out what yours is and how you can become plugged in. Last thing I would say is that it's important for you to reach out to your friends and colleagues to get them to see this other side of Austin and talk about these difficult discussions we don't like to talk about. We've talked about housing and education and wages and now social services. And these are all, you know, fundamental things. And I had one last thought. You know, Austin is so beautiful after a 3-inch rain. And if we could get it to rain 20 miles to the west, it would be so much prettier. But we can't control the rain, right? We can do a lot to conserve water, but we can't control the rain. And traffic is really tough. And the three big things we've got as problems in this city are water, traffic, and this last issue we're talking about, which is this great divide that we have as a city. And as difficult as it is for people to talk about, and hard as it is to get that conversation started, it's the one we can do the most about. So, I congratulate Leadership Austin for their great leadership and continuing the dialogue and making sure that we're facing the realities of who we are, not who we say we are, so that we can literally be that city that we want to be. So, thank you. Thanks to KXAN for their partnership. And so, I turn it back over to Shannon. Thanks very much.
Well, Paul just stole my entire intro, so no kidding. I'm Shannon Wolfson, and I'm the evening anchor at KXAN, and we are so honored always to partnership with Leadership Austin on these breakfasts. Part of the core purpose at KXAN is to enrich our community, and we know that these discussions help to do that and help to find solutions. So thank you all for being here this morning. It is certainly an honor to be here today to help lead this discussion. I have a question. Julie asked how many people had this was their first breakfast or had been here before. I'm curious how many people have been here for a breakfast in this Growing Divide series. Can you raise your hand? Excellent. Well, I'm happy to hear that. So you certainly know what we're talking about and why it is so important. And as Paul mentioned, this series has looked at the inequities that exist in our community from a lot of angles. We have heard about the east-west socioeconomic divide and the poverty rates that are growing further from our city's core when it comes to affordability. We've discussed this divide through that lens, education, jobs, wages. We've asked a lot of tough questions, as you know, if you have been here with us, about how people of different races and backgrounds and income levels are impacted. So today, as we bring this series to a close, we're going to be addressing the ability that our social sector has to tackle inequality and to serve those in need. And I am very excited to be joined by this panel who knows so much about this topic. And I want to introduce them to you. They are really leaders in our region's health and human services organizations. Let's start at the end, almost at the end. Lindsay, I'll get back to you. We are privileged to have a city council member, as some of you know, in each of these discussions about Austin's growing divide. And today we're joined by Delia Garza, who represents District 2 and serves on the council's Health and Human Services Committee. Councilmember Garza's years of work as a firefighter, community advocate, and attorney for social services have afforded her extensive experience in addressing injustices and solving complex problems, and we are so glad to have her perspective in this conversation today. Next to Councilmember Garza is Matt Corey. He is a social entrepreneur and chief executive officer of Green Lights, where he leads the organization's efforts to solve big community problems through the power of high-performing nonprofits and their partners. And he brings with him, trust me, extensive expertise in innovative social sector practices, and he'll be sharing new research with us this morning about the state of our nonprofit sector, not just here, but nationwide. And then next to me is Sherry Fleming, who serves as the Travis County Executive for Health and Human Services and Veterans Services. And in this role, Sherry oversees more than $18 million in social service contracts with local nonprofits and public health services provided by provided to Travis County residents, bringing a very important voice to today's discussion. Sherry, thank you for being here also. And then down at the end is my colleague and friend, Lindsay Bramson. She represents your voice in this discussion today. She'll be sharing your thoughts and questions submitted through text message. So you can join in this conversation today by texting 22333 and entering ENG1415 at the beginning of your question. I see you all are writing that down. You're not, because the instructions are in the middle of your tables. And we hope you participate in that way, because that really is your chance to talk to us and let this panel know what you're thinking and get your questions answered. So please do text in your questions, and Lindsay will be asking those throughout the morning. All right. We want to set the scene this morning, and I think Paul did a pretty good job of doing that earlier, but I want to do that now by hearing first from Matt. And as we talk about the need in our community and the role the social sector is playing in meeting that need, Matt, I'm curious to know from you how we're doing and what are some of the primary findings that Greenlight's most recent research has found.
Sure. Thank you, Shannon. I think if I were to sum it up briefly, in solving this community's and this region's most complex social problems, we're doing good, but not great. Our research shows that our nonprofit sector, which is the primary vehicle through which our problems are getting solved, certainly government plays a role in that. Business plays a role in that. The faith communities play a role in that. But the nonprofit sector is the primary vehicle for social change in our community. And our On the Verge research that we just completed earlier this year showed that our nonprofit sector, our social sector, is doing a lot of good. We are robust. We have 6,000 nonprofit organizations, 501c3 public charities in this region, making a lot of inroads on some of these complex problems that we'll talk about today. But at the same time, that sector is struggling in many ways. The fact that we have so many more nonprofits on a per capita basis than any city or community in the southwestern United States, in fact, can also be a challenge, because most of our nonprofits are smaller. Only 72% of those organizations have income below $100,000. 72%. Only 15% of those nonprofit organizations have even one staff person. So we're talking about just a few hundred nonprofit organizations that are able to achieve the scale to make a difference. And so we believe a couple of things have to be done. One, those organizations have to double down on their effectiveness. They have to invest in themselves and in their growth. We're in the business of accelerating the most breakout ready and the most innovative organizations to get to the scale where they can actually begin to move needles on these problems. But I think most importantly and most uniquely, Austin, our social sector has to find new ways to work together across sectors. We have to broaden the aperture of what we mean by the social sector outside of just nonprofits. We have to embrace partnerships with government and business that are effective. We have to do more collective action work, and we're seeing that happening, but we need a great deal more of it. And then lastly, I think we need to embrace lots of new innovative forms of business models and investment of human and financial capital. When you think about what makes Austin so great is we've got a robust economy. We've got business entrepreneurs and private sector leaders who haven't met a technology problem or a business problem that they can't solve. That's why Austin is doing so well. Why can't we apply that same energy, that same enthusiasm, that same innovation and entrepreneurship to our social sector? We ought to be able to actually solve our chronically homeless problem in this community. We have the financial resources to do it. We have the social entrepreneurs, but we're not necessarily connecting those in the ways that they need to be connected. And so, in sum, I think we're doing well, but we're not getting there. And clearly the evidence shows that. This series is pointing that out. We have to think differently. We have to act differently. And we have to work together very, very differently.
Councilmember Garza, I'd like to go to you, and I'm going to ask the same question of both you and Sherry. Do you also feel like this is the reality, what Matt was saying? And I'm curious, where do you see the most need in our community?
Yeah, I think that Austin's doing a good job, but we could do better. Closer. I got a little belly here that prevents me from getting too close. We could be doing better. There are a lot of challenges we face, but there's also a lot of opportunities. Austin, and I know there was a comment earlier about comparing ourselves to peer cities and not wanting to do that, but sometimes that's the only comparison that we have. And compared to peer cities, Austin city government funding to social services is significantly lower than other cities like San Antonio and Seattle and San Francisco. And so there were some council initiatives. The last council did some initiatives that asked for that report and asked to see those numbers, and they indeed came back showing that we're not funding our social services the way we should be. And so there is an effort now to increase the funding to social services. And as far as need, it depends on who you ask. Mm-hmm. For me, that's the thing about social service funding is it depends on who's in office at that time, mm-hmm. and what they focus on and what matters to them. And so, you know, a lot of the first meetings that I took as a council member were advocates, you know, doing their due diligence and asking, you know, and showing this is what's important. Particularly for me, I guess every council person has their issues that matter a lot to them. And for me in my district, our health and wellness issues, our childhood obesity issues, food deserts. My district has more food deserts than any other district. So it depends on which council member you ask, but they're all very important things, and you know a lot of them affect each other. If we do better at workforce development, we give people the tools to have more money in their pockets, to provide better food, to provide that car that they need that maybe they didn't have. They have to depend on Cap Metro. So a lot of these things affect each other, affect the whole picture. So I think we're on the right track. We recognize that we're not doing as good as we can be, and hopefully we're moving in a better direction now.
Yeah. Sherry, from a county perspective, what do you see as being this something we need the most in the community that we're not reaching?
Well, you know, good morning, everyone, and I'm very pleased and humbled by the opportunity to be here. And while I don't want to overwhelm you with a bunch of numbers, I think a couple numbers are appropriate. And first is that Travis County, as of 2013, had 1.1 million people. So if you didn't know, now you know. But most importantly to the county, 26% of those people, or about 293,000, live in the unincorporated areas of Travis County. And that means outside of any incorporated area that you know about. So any of the small cities or villages, those folks are out completely outside of an incorporated city. And many of our residents experience some degree of geographic isolation or linguistic isolation. And so just those two things are an extreme call to us to try to do business differently. And while we are blessed with so many nonprofits doing such wonderful work, one of the things that the county had to come to terms with is that only about 5% of the investments that we were making in the community. Now, we're Travis County, remember, but only 5% of those investments could we track to persons who lived out in the unincorporated areas of the community. So that was a big aha for us. Mm-hmm. And so it is important for us to think about how do we do business differently, because many of the populations that we have set a mission to serve are no longer in the city core. And so how do we look at our service delivery and make sure that we reach those individuals who may have less and less opportunity to reach us?
Well, I think I'd like to kind of go to Matt on that one, because we have talked about the fact that, you know, in the city of Austin, we talk a lot about how the poverty rate has gone down percentage-wise, and that's wonderful. But the fact of the matter is, in our outlying areas, the poverty rate is going up, and that directly is part of the affordability of Austin and people not being able to afford to live here and moving out. And so, because of that, don't have access to the social services that are in the city's core. How do we solve that problem in getting those people access to the services they need, say, if they can't get here?
Sure. That's a sticky wicket, no question. There are incredible market forces at work in this community that are causing that. The affordability of Austin is driven by our great success, right? And so I don't know that there's a magic bullet or a master plan that we could come up with today to make Austin a more affordable city, right? We have to take it step by step. We have to find and invest in, I think, the most innovative organizations in this community that are making a difference. I look at what Foundation Communities is doing in buying up and making really high quality affordable housing in this community, in Travis County and Central Texas mostly. But we also have to build the infrastructure in the region. And what we find is that the vast majority of organizations working in this space, in the social sector, are in Travis County. And most of the funding for those organizations comes in Travis County. When you go to Bastrop and Pflugerville and Williamson County and Hayes, there's just not a lot of social sector activity. And there are not a lot of resources, but I want to make a point here, and I don't mean any offense to my government partners here, but the total amount of funding that's the fuel in the engine for our social sector in the subsectors that we call health and mental health and human services of those 6,000, about a third of organizations are in those two categories. They generate about $1.8 billion in revenue every year to run their economic engines to serve people. The city and the county funding, if I got the numbers right, was about $50 million of that. $50 million out of $1.8 billion. And so we do need more funding, and we do need more creative funding. We need our government to act differently. But the real solution is going to be with you guys. You know, the vast majority of the fuel in the engine of most social sector organizations comes from individuals writing checks, not from government, not from from business even. And so each of you here today and where you live in your communities, and I suspect many of you aren't from Austin or don't live in Austin or Travis County anymore, you have the ability to engage in what's happening in social service organizations, in the local governments, in the region, to begin to build that infrastructure up and make our region less Austin-centric. And so that there's an infrastructure problem. We can look at transportation as a way to address that, and I think kind of the regional transportation planning that's happening is working, beginning to work, to make sure that folks have access to food and to services and to this community. But the whole dynamic is changing, and we can't continue to act like we're a one-city, small-town community.
So Matt was talking obviously about funding and some creative ways that we need to think about funding these services. But Councilmember Garza, I'm curious to know from you, if you could talk a little bit about the funding for health and human services through tax dollars as compared to other cities. Sure. Specifically, I know you talked a little bit about it earlier. And what are the gaps you see in the budget for the city of Austin?
Well, specifically for Austin, the numbers that I know we didn't want to get too much into the numbers, but 2% of Austin's budget is for health and human services funding, and that's the lowest compared to Denver, San Antonio, and San Francisco, and Seattle. San Antonio's percentage is 6%, so almost three times, and Austin's getting real close to being comparable to San Antonio as far as population. They're at about 1.something million, and Travis County is 1.1 million, so Austin's pretty close to that funding. To the to the point of that government provides a really, really small percentage of funding, I would agree with that, but I would have to say that we definitely don't, cities and counties don't fund just because we're dying to give money away. We're doing it because there's a gap to fill. And if that gap wasn't there, if there wasn't the need there, we wouldn't be funding those things. And so, and it is all about budget. It's about revenue in and revenue out, and so we're limited. We're limited by tax dollars. We're limited by how we tax tax our citizens. And so there are concerns when during campaign season and ways to make Austin more affordable when we're having these discussions. And for example, when discussions of a possible homestead exemption comes up, we have to think about how that affects our budget, and how if you reduced the money coming in to the city budget, what politician could be against tax reform? You know, it's a popular thing, and you want to support that, and you want to be able to get out there and say I supported a tax reduction. But I really hope that when the discussion of a possible homestead exemption starts, I hope we can look at how that affects our budget and how and what that could take out of our budget. And when we're already in a position where we're funding so much lower compared to other cities, how is that going to affect these critical services that we provide? And as a former firefighter, I will say many of our medical calls were calls that should not have escalated to a 911 call. They were calls that if these people had access to critical health care and services, they wouldn't have called 911. And now you're in a position where you're sending $1 million fire truck, and that's not cost effective when you're sending mm-hmm. fire trucks to go help people because there's lack of these there's mm-hmm. this lack of services.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to talk a little bit about that. And I mean, this that opens up a huge window in how do we increase that funding from 2%. And be more on par with other cities, but also because you brought it up, you know we have to talk about mental health services in this area, and I think we all agree that we are not doing enough in that area. I know my colleague Robert Hadlock did a story about a new mental health facility opening up at a University Medical Center Brackenridge, and the beds were full before the facility even opened. They already had so many patients, and I'm just curious how you all feel. Maybe Sherry, you can address this. We can better serve people who need mental health services in this community.
Well, I think if I had the super answer, I would be excited. I think we all would. But I think, most importantly, it should be unacceptable to us as a community to hear some of these things. And, in government, we hear as much as you do, if not more, about tax fatigue, and all of us in this room, we're taxpayers, and we certainly want to make sure that our government's investments are going toward those things that are efficient and effective, and that there is concern for the taxpayer dollar. But as important, if not more important than that, is being able to provide the services that our community needs. And in order to do that, we really have to rise up and say we support those services being delivered in the community. It is unacceptable for somebody to have to wait for a mental health bed at a time when they most need it. And so for us, I think that, certainly government and government staff, we can put those issues out there, but your elected officials respond to what you say. And what you say is important. And that is as critical now as it has ever been, to communicate what you believe their priorities should be. And if our priorities should be mental health services, social services, housing, oh my God, if those are the priorities that are important to you, then those messages have to be communicated to your elected officials. Because at the end of the day, you're the ones whose support matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I absolutely agree. The question to how do we increase that funding is you make it a priority. You support people who make it a priority. And I speak about how wonderful the 10-1 system is now because you have representatives who live in these communities and who go drive into these communities and understand the issues. I remember a meeting with an advocate. I think it was not Echo, but one of the nonprofits, and I see many of them are represented here. And the concern was, you know, we're concerned about this 10-1 system because we're concerned that we had council members who really paid attention to certain things, and now we're afraid, you know, that's not going to be there. And my response was, you have that even more now because I drive into my district where the median income is $38,000, and isn't that amazing that people can still live in Austin on $38,000? And so, yes, you make it a priority. You go in there during budget discussions, and you advocate. I advocate for things that matter to me, and so that's how I think this 10-1 system is already providing so many wonderful benefits. And this will be another one of that. Is that you have council members who live in these communities where these needs are, and they will make those a priority.
This is. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is flying by, so I really want to get some audience questions, Lindsay, if we have any coming in.
We do. We actually have a lot of good questions coming in. I've just been looking at them over the last few minutes. And Councilmember Garza, I believe this is a good one for you. Somebody in the audience wants to know, how will the City of Austin increase social services funding when each department is being asked to make a 5% cut in the next budget cycle?
That's a great question. And the reason that 5% is being asked is because of a directive to ask where we can make room for a homestead exemption, which is not something that I support. So I think it's kind of impossible to ask, to say on one hand, we need to be funding social services more, and then to say on the other, but, you know, we want to, but how do we cut budgets? You really can't do both. So I got a lot of calls when that memo went out, people concerned about their jobs, you know, parks and rec department funding being cut, libraries being cut, pools being closed, and, you know, all of those cuts affect health and human services, and they certainly affect children in my district when pool hours are closed, and that affects quality of life. And so again, I have big concerns about the conversation coming up about a homestead exemption and the possibility that it could cut $36 million from the general fund.
Lindsay?
Yep. So somebody else wants to know, probably for maybe Sherry or Matt, how do we get our nonprofits and our businesses to work together?
I'd be happy. Oh, go ahead, Sherry.
Okay. Well, I think from my perspective, funders have to require it. And so I know from the county's perspective, we have recently put out some resources that it would be very difficult to accomplish what it is that we've set out to accomplish by not working together, because it requires an approach to serving families across several different sectors. And so, you know, it's like with anything else. I mean, even as employees, if this is where I get my paycheck and my boss says this is what I want to be done, then I guess we're going to do it, right? If we still want that paycheck. And so I think it first starts with the expectation of funders.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you have some interesting ideas about alternative funding. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's a really prescient question. And frankly, I think that's where more of the answer is to what we're talking about today. Again, I love what the city and the county are doing. I think I applaud you for those efforts. But what I tell nonprofit leaders is, you know, all of that energy that you're spending sort of at the county and at the city sort of lobbying for, you know, this percentage or that contract, divert some of that energy to making your organization a more attractive partner or target for the business community. I mean, the vast majority of wealth in this community sits with the business leaders and the businesses that are here. And what they tell me is that they're not seeing in our nonprofit sector the kinds of investment-ready business models that would attract, I think, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars of investment capital. And so we're doing some great things at Greenlights. We've got a group of 110 business leaders who are social venture partners. They're philanthropists, and they're looking at the nonprofit sector almost like the venture capital sector. Where do we find great breakout-ready companies, right, organizations who are ready for new kinds of investment? Easter Seals is a great example. Their CEO, Todd Marvin, who they received both city and county contracts, but he has a vision, a goal of making Easter Seals, which provides services to some of the folks we're talking about today with disabilities, children, and adults, making them completely unreliant in, you know, 15 or 20 years on government or even philanthropic funding to create a social venture model. They've just started a residential lawn and landscape business, you know, a for-profit business within a nonprofit organization. If you want to get your yard cut next week, call Easter Seals Lawn and Landscape. They employ adults with disabilities, are creating jobs, and they're doing so within a creative venture market. They just went out to the business community and said, we've got an investable deal. Rather than going and throwing another golf tournament or going to the city and lobbying for more money, we're going to create a loan that we could take. And they got, in about 3 days, $50,000 in investment capital from the business sector to grow this social business. All of our nonprofit leaders need to be thinking like that. How do we innovate? How do we create opportunities for investment?
Sort of going off, Matt, what you were just saying, as someone in the audience, a question for really all three of you, but while we're talking about innovative, somebody says, how do you assess a program as innovative, and how do you evaluate social impact outcomes? Really, any of you can probably tackle that one.
People define innovative, in a hundred different ways. It's the new buzzword, right? But I think we've got to figure out the answer to that question. I don't think it's just new or flashy or exciting or startup, right? And that's not what I'm saying. I don't think we need a new startup type things, but there are ideas that are working in the for-profit world, and business models that are working in the for-profit world, and around the world literally, that we ought to be adopting in the social sector. We ought to use the power of market forces for good, right? One of the forms of innovation that we're seeing is just the idea of the nonprofit world, period. I don't like that word. Why do we call ourselves the nonprofit sector? It's a negative. It's not even true. We can make profit. So let's innovate that model and be open to broadening the aperture of what we mean by, you know, maybe we call it a mission-driven organizations that might be for-profit organizations but are in business to do good. I'm becoming less and less worried about an organization's tax status as long as they're able to show the kind of outcomes that are worth doing. We're going to be featuring, if you're interested in learning what's going on in this community, on your tables, June 3rd, a great event coming up, Austin Next. We've got 16 of what we think are the most innovative nonprofit and for-profit mission-driven organizations, and we're going to be featuring them. The mayor's going to be there to speak and talk about his vision of what social innovation is that evening on June 3rd. And so I think those 16 organizations and what you can learn about how they're moving the needle in their little corner of this community, that's the answer to that question, social innovation.
And if I could just... I think we have to look at best practice. I mean, there are things that are happening in the sector that are best practices or promising practices, and I think we sort of have to spend a little bit of money also to have independent evaluations. And I think we're at a period of time now where people don't scoff at evaluations probably the way they used to. I can remember a time when you talked about spending money on evaluation, people thought, well, that's money you could put in the programs, right? So I think we have to look at what we're doing. We have to compare it to other communities, as we started out earlier. And yes, there are some things that are uniquely Austin and Travis County, and we celebrate that. But by the same token, it's like my grandmother used to say, you're not a prophet in your own land, you know? So you sort of have to look at the prophets in in other lands and compare what you're doing to what they're doing, and actually maybe even be able to show that what we're doing here is so much better because of this, this, and this, versus just continuing to do what we do without much evidence of success.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, just so it's not all gloom and doom up here, what are we doing well? You said there are things that are working. So what are we doing well and that we could continue to do better?
Well, I think in this community, we should celebrate the fact that our social sector partners are working together. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have great collaborations in this community, some of which have been here before we even learned the word collaboration. And I think that's important to say. We know how to do collaboration here in the community, and we should require it of new people who come into the community. You know, guess what? We do have nonprofits in this community, and if you're coming in to be a nonprofit in this community, guess what? We work together around here. So let's make sure you have that as part of your repertoire. So just in general terms, we do work and play well together. We don't always agree, but we certainly do work together, and I'll mm-hmm. let my other panelists chime in.
Just a couple of examples. There's so many out there, but I think what we're doing around homelessness is really unique. And around housing first, I think what ECHO's doing in having received one of the only kind of federal incentivized awards to study this new model of financing our social services called Pay for Success. There's some great promise there. What Alan Graham is doing at Community First out in East Austin is a great example of one innovative nonprofit organization gathering a bunch of partners, for-profit, nonprofit. Seton's there, and HEB's there, and so many partners to try to actually solve the homeless problem. That's a great example of innovation and collaboration working together. There's a huge movement right now that we're fortunate to be a part of at Greenlight's called the Travis County Collaborative for Children, which is a 50-agency, public, private, and nonprofit initiative. It's not a collaboration. It's not a collaboration. It's a collective impact, move the needle for foster kids. You know, 2,000 kids languish in our foster care system just in Travis County alone. And they are working aggressively to move that needle in a really creative way. So it's not all gloom and doom. There's a lot of hope. We're doing a lot of really, really good. We need to magnify that and do more of it.
Yes, I would agree. I think we're doing well in collaboration. One example, the Dove Springs Rec Center recently got an amazing playscape that I would say is the best in the city. and that was an amazing collaboration with St. David's, the Parks Foundation. And I think there is a... it was out of necessity because our parks are really, really underfunded. They went out and they collaborated and built this really, really great mm-hmm. space for Dove Springs. I think other things the city's doing well is investing in workforce development. Capital Idea has a wonderful program. Goodwill, our contract with Goodwill requires reports on the impact of it. So speaking to the question of how do we measure impacts, that's part of the contract is they have to show these positive outcomes. So I would say workforce development, we're doing well, and collaborating with them when the need's there, for example, like with our Parks and Rec Department. They're doing a great job of collaborating for private funding to get these great benefits for our community.
Phew. Okay, good. I think that makes us all feel better. Lindsay, I'd like to get some more audience questions.
Let's go. This is another good one I wanted to get to. Someone in the audience wants to know, how do we and how should we assess and balance the need for funding treatment of social problems versus prevention? Probably Sherry, I would think, one for you.
Well, you know, I'm all about prevention. I think that once again, it's a matter of priorities. And many of you in this room probably have heard me say, you know, if we were IBM, we could be all about our research and development and our bottom line. But for some reason, when we get to talking about government, you know, one of the biggest costs at the county is operating a jail. And unfortunately, the jail continues to be the largest mental health facility in this community. And so if we can invest in services at the front end so people don't have to be in trouble to get help. I mean, that's a huge bottom line affecting intervention, is to have the services that we need out in the community before there has to be a law enforcement intervention.
How do we do that?
We make it a priority. We communicate those as priorities. You know, I think I said earlier, your elected officials want to do what's important to you. And so if we don't communicate that, then they sort of have to respond to what I would not disrespectfully call the noise. You know, what's the loudest voice? What is the bright, shiny penny at that particular time versus a systematic and steady course of intervention that can make true change in our community?
Yeah, I would always advocate for as much funding going into prevention as opposed to what ends up the result. And I'll go back to the fire truck analogy. When you, if a lot of these people had been, if we'd reached them sooner, we'd be spending a lot less money. I was told a story. I think it was the CEO of St. David's told me the story about homelessness and how they had a situation where a mother was homeless. She had three children, and I think an aunt had taken them in, but the aunt couldn't sustain that anymore. It was just becoming too much. She wanted to have them there. And a social worker went out there and said, what's the biggest challenge? Like, why can't you keep this family in your home? Because she wanted to keep them in the home. And she said, a grocery bill. Like, the grocery bill is just, I can't afford the grocery bill. And she was asked, well, how much is your grocery bill? And she said, it's gone up like $200 a month. And she was asked, if we give you $200 a month, will that fix the problem? And she said, yes. And so they were able to find, whereas instead of having a mother with three children homeless, having to get all these other services, $200 fixed that problem. Mm-hmm. So how do we do that? Is we invest in the social workers and the network that allows us to get to those problems before they turn into a mom on the street with three kids in her car.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay?
Matt, you had mentioned nonprofits investing in themselves. What's the strategy for how we overcome the negative stigma associated with raising funds?
Yes, I hear people refer to it as begging for money, right? Nonprofits should stop begging for money. I don't like that. We have great leaders of our nonprofit organizations in this community, and so I don't want to disparage them. They give tirelessly of their time, their talent, and their treasure. Many of them are entrepreneurial. They could be making a lot more money in other places. In fact, our data showed that in Austin, our nonprofit staff and leaders are making well below even the state average in salary. So these people are sacrificing significantly. At the same time, we're in this business, this strange business of sort of taking other people's money and using it to inject ourselves into other people's lives. And so there's a higher standard for that. And so we at Greenlight spend a lot of time working on and developing the leaders of these organizations and infusing into them and into their organizations increased capacity, both to raise money. We're not saying that philanthropy is broken or needs to go away. I mean, this country is an incredibly generous country, and at the same time, despite all the economic ups and downs, the average giving percentage in the nation in America has stayed right around 2 or 3%, you know, from the 1800s, no matter how wealthy we've gotten. So, you know, so philanthropy is probably only going to get us so far. And so we spend a lot of time helping nonprofit leaders through our accelerator and our leadership development services to think a little bit differently and to embrace innovation. Nonprofits are inherently risk averse. Right, but when you look at most of our successful companies, you know, they're some of the biggest risk takers there are, and they're open to failure and failing often and failing fast and failing forward. You know, most nonprofit leaders, you know, me included, we're afraid to fail because we're taking other people's money to insert ourselves into other people's lives. But we've got to create a culture in this community where innovation can happen and failure can happen, and we're okay with it. And where funders and investors in nonprofits don't see a single failed program or a program that didn't meet the outcomes that it was expected to meet as a total failure, but as a learning opportunity to be able to figure it out and do it better next time.
So we have time for one more audience question, I think.
Okay, so sort of going off of that, I think another very important question, and we have so many, and so I apologize if we haven't gotten to yours, but someone says, you know, there are lots of funders in this room right now. How can we get funders together to align support for the programs that we really do need?
I think that kind of goes back to the question of what do we need, because it depends on who you're asking. And that might be more of a Matt question, because that's his job. Well, to bring those people together.
I'm seeing a lot of great things on our funding community collaborating. The city and the county are working together collaboratively on some really innovative funding and financing things that we're fortunate to be a part of with great organizations. I get to see, you know, the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation and the St. David's Foundation sort of at the table with our government leaders. And at the same time, many of our funders in this community are first generation money and tend to be relatively narrowly focused and tend to be relatively traditional in their thinking of, I give a grant and, you know, and I hope that that money does that money does well. And so I love what Sherry said about the funders expecting kind of new business models and expecting collaboration. Funders have tremendous power to do that and to speak with one voice to say, we're going to support the most innovative, the most collectively good things in this community. We have a lot of maturation that needs to happen in the next 10 to 15 years in our funding community. And I like the leadership that I'm seeing so far from the city and the county on that as well.
And I would just say, if there are a lot of people in this room who could get together, then stay after the breakfast and check name tags and start talking to each other. Because that's certainly a part of what this is about. So I would like to just ask you all, and this is probably going to be our last question before I ask you what you can ask of the people in this room to do. But my question is, what are the really hard questions about this issue that we haven't addressed, that are really hard to talk about, maybe a little uncomfortable, that we're not talking about, and that maybe don't get talked about enough? Mm-hmm. Sherry?
Well, for me, I can't leave this stage without talking about housing, and it's mostly because Ann Howard is here, and I'm afraid of her. But you know, oftentimes, you know, people think, well, I have housing, I can afford housing, so, you know, why is this important? We are competing for housing in this community. People with money versus people who don't have money. And if you think it is just an issue of whether you have money or not, I challenge you to think differently about that, because if you have parents that you might have to move to this community at some point that you need to have closer to you, but they want to live on their own, where are they going to live? If you have children that you hope will be out of your house at some point, where are they going to live? And so it is not just an issue of those of us who do this work every day. Every one of us in here is affected by the lack of affordable housing in this community. And so if you hear nothing else today, educate yourselves on what is truly a crisis in our community and how you can help with that.
Yeah.
I think a hard question is, are we going to be a city that's known for solving, you know, actually solving our community problems in a uniquely Austin way? And then that Austin way, I think, is are we going to be embracing of the blurring of lines between social value and economic value? Are we going to be okay with paying our best and brightest social entrepreneurs, you know, market wages to attract the brightest thinking into this business of solving people's problems? Are we going to be okay with for-profit organizations that have a social purpose emerging in our community and getting investments from our foundations and from our government agencies because they've figured out the secret sauce to solve a particular problem. I think Austin can do that. I think we've got a unique mix of an incredibly innovative, robust business community, a very progressive and engaged government sector, and a strong and getting stronger nonprofit sector. But we've got to break down some of those traditional barriers of, you know, this is charity and this is government and that's business. We're blurring that together, and that's what it's going to take, I think, to solve these problems.
Yeah, and from a government perspective, I think the hard questions for some people are what is the role of government? Is the role of government to be should, you know, with the pool closure conversation that came up, the response was, well, if this was a private business, we're losing money. And my response to that is it's not a private business. Government can't be. We can't run it that way. It is about community benefits. So those are some hard conversations to have, what the role of government is when it comes to social service funding. And I think another one is a lot of times, the NIMBY theory, not in my backyard. Like, I think that affordable housing is great, but then when it might be next door, you know, all of a sudden you don't want that affordable housing. And so those are some difficult questions to ask. And I think it's a religious quote, but it's one of, we will be judged by how we treat the least among us. And I think that that's true. We really need to think about that, how many of you have done really well for yourselves, and you should be very proud of that. But we're Austin, and we need to be thinking about the least among us and how we keep those families here, because when we have mixed housing and mixed incomes together, studies have shown that lower income families are more able to come out of poverty when they're living among people who aren't in poverty. And so and that's one of the reasons I fell in love with Austin. It's such a different city, and I love that we're having these hard conversations.
Yeah. And heading into this last question and kind of along those lines, you know, something my mom always used to tell us is that to whom much is given, much is required, which I'm sure you've all heard. And you know, a lot of us are very fortunate in this room, obviously, and in this community. So as we close today, I'd like each of you to just briefly talk a little bit about one, we call it the call to action, actionable way that the people in this room can make a positive impact on what we're talking about today. And maybe we'll start with Councilmember Garza.
Sure. I would say something you could do soon is be part of the budget conversation on the city side. We have our annual budget review coming up, and send an email to your council. We talked about priorities and making things a priority. Send an email. There's a real easy way on the city's website where you can click on send an email to the entire council, and it does send it. And we get those emails. I get those emails. And so that's a way. And go to City Hall, speak at Citizens Communication, find the issue that matters to you, and go speak in front of the council. It's a lot harder, I'll be honest, to vote against something when you have 300 people there telling you, you know, why you shouldn't. So get involved. Get involved in your city. I really feel that your city level has the most impact on your life, which I'm always amazed at the low voter turnout for city elections. But that's a way to just start with an email and then go from there.
Right. I would say invest in a social entrepreneur in this community, in one of the organizations that we know is making a difference. Invest your financial capital. Write a check. Show up to volunteer, give your human capital. You can, you know, look at these 16 organizations on the bottom of this flyer. These are vetted organizations that are doing some of the most good in this community, and they can use your help. And every little dollar, every little hour, makes a huge difference. And these and many, many others are worthy of your support. You can come on June 3rd and meet their CEOs and hear their vision for this community. But it's one little action, one little investment rolled up over and over and over again in this community that I think is going to ultimately make the kind of change that we need to see.
Sherry?
And I would say all of the above. You guys stole all my thunder there. But absolutely, get involved. you can email your commissioners, the county judge as well. You can speak at Citizens Communication over at the county. But I also want to echo what Matt said. You know, 6,000 nonprofits, find a nonprofit that speaks to your heart. Mm-hmm. And yes, your money is important and it's much needed, but your time as well. You know, I think one of the things that I know the partners that I work with, it's the administrative costs, the business costs of running the nonprofits. And so if you have a talent that you can share with those nonprofits, you may be helping them to channel more money out into the community just by that, what you might think is just a little bit of service. Mm-hmm. And so find at least one that speaks to you and support them both with your labor and your finances.
Amen. Thank you all so much for being here this morning. Thank you all for being here and participating. We really appreciate it.
Well, just as Shannon mentioned, we're getting ready to close out the series for the year. So we've got one more event, and that also is going to be on June 3rd. So as a reminder, as Councilmember Garza talked about, the fall we spent time talking about engagement, voices, the leadership changes that were coming in the community, and our role and responsibility for that. This spring we spent time on the growing divide between the topics we've talked about. So we'll close the series on June 3rd with the issuing of our report on civic engagement coming out of the 10-1 election. That's the research we've been doing with the University of Texas. It'll be a joint report that our essential class project was this year. So we'll issue the executive summary at the June 3rd breakfast. And that will be followed by a conversation between Mayor Adler and County Judge Eckhart. What they're feeling, what they're sensing now coming out, and that would close this year's series. So we hope to see y'all back next time. We also are in the middle of accepting applications for our two programs. The labels are on people's chests. You can ask them. Applications are due the end of June. Y'all, thank you again for the day, and we'll see you in early June.